Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to attempt to discuss with you Leviticus chapter 21, verses 1 through 24, how to keep a priest holy, rules for the priest. This will be the first part of the discussion. The discussion continues in chapter 22, first part of chapter 22, which we'll take up in the next audio. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 21, we discussed laws against child sacrifice and against various forms of sexual immorality and incest. So now we start with Leviticus 21, verses 1 through 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the priest, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, 'No one shall defile himself for a dead person among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, his mother and his father and his son and his daughter and his brother. Also for his virgin sister who is near to him, because she has no husband, for her he may defile himself. He shall not defile himself as a relative by marriage among his people, and so profane himself.'" Now these rules are concerning funeral customs, because as you know, touching a corpse or entering the home of the deceased, according to the law, would make one unclean. We know that because in Numbers 19:11 we see a prohibition against touching a corpse. Quote, "The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. Also, entering the home of the deceased would make one unclean." Numbers 19:14. "This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. So that's the general rule. Now, we're looking at rules for the priest, not necessarily the high priest, but the priest in general. Verse 1 says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Speak to the priest.'" So we're talking about the ordinary priest. He can't defile himself by touching a dead person, but an exception is made for them in verse 2, except for his relatives who are nearest to him. Somebody's got to take care of the funeral arrangements, and the law gives an escape hatch, a loophole, for priests who need to take care of the funeral arrangements for his near relative, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, his immediate family, and plus his brother. Also for his virgin sister, who has no husband because she's a virgin, and if she was married, of course, the husband would take care of the funeral arrangements and it wouldn't be a problem. But so this is a very practical exception to the general rule against being defiled by a dead person. Now, we're going to see as we get down to verses 11 and 12 in this chapter, that this exception does not apply to the high priest. The high priest was so holy, he couldn't touch the corpse or touch anything that's associated with his dead nearest relatives. We'll see that in a minute. Now, one little problem here in verse 1, close relatives, that's the exception. Priests can touch the corpses of dead relatives or go into their homes, no problem. But what about a wife of a priest? Now, verse 2 says, "Except for his relatives who are nearest to him," in that case, the priest would not be defiled. Wife is not mentioned. We got mother, father, son, daughter, all blood relatives. A wife is not really a blood relative. She's into the family by marriage. And so then the question arises, well, what happens if the priest's wife dies? Can he not handle the funeral arrangements? Well, I think the argument is, as John Gill puts it, the argument seems to be a good argument that wife should be included in those who are nearest to him. After all, the law says, except for his relatives who are nearest to him. And then the law gives some examples. Well, it would go without saying, who could be closer than a wife? All the examples that are given, as Gill points out, for whom the exception applies, mother, father, son, and daughter, and brother, none of them are as close as a wife. A wife's even closer. So obviously the exception is going to apply to the wife. So the priest can handle the funeral of his deceased wife. We go now to verses 5 and 6 in Leviticus 21. "They," that means the priest, "shall not make any baldness on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts in their flesh. They shall be holy to their God, and not profane the name of their God, for they present the offerings by fire to the Lord, the food of their God, so they shall be holy." Now this prohibition against baldness on the heads or shaving the edge of the beards was, I've already talked about, actually, because it's mentioned in Leviticus 19:27. "You shall not round off the side growth of your heads, nor horn the edges of your beard." Now, what that means is anybody's guess. The translations differ a little bit. Round off, cut, the side growth of your head. Some people says that it ends up making your head look like a bowl, like a medieval monk, because that's what the Egyptians looked like, and they had square beards as the edge of the beard was cut off. Some people say the beard was totally shaved, totally bald. I don't know. Doesn't matter. I do know that the priests who were being talked to would know what was being referred to, because they would be familiar with the practices of pagan preachers, pagan priests, and so they would know that they're not to imitate those pagan priests in their shaving practices. So the fact that we don't know exactly what it is no big deal. We do know that from monuments and mummies that the Egyptians used to either cut or shave off their whiskers. We also know that hair was much used in divination among the ancients, as Adam Clark says. So the idea is we're not going to allow hair to have anything to do with our priestly services. Here's what Adam Clark says about Egyptian priests. Quote, according to Herodotus, they shaved the whole body every third day that there might be no uncleanness about them when they ministered in their temples. This appears to have been a general custom among the heathen. In the book of Baruch 6, verse 31, the priests of Babylon are represented sitting in their temples with their clothes rent and their heads and beards shaven and having nothing upon their heads. Every person knows the tonsure of the Catholic priest. Should not this be avoided as an approach to a heathenish custom? Well, almost everything in the Catholic Church is an approach to a heathenish custom, because the Catholic Church has sucked in heathenish customs galore. But I don't know if we can get them for violating the Old Testament law, of course, because they're not under the Old Testament law, so I'm not going to go there. I know that a lot of Hollywood movies, when you look at Egyptian priests, they're bald as a cue ball. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We don't know. We do know that shaving beards and cutting the flesh is an age-old sign of not only idolatry, but also mourning. And I'm going to give you two verses in the Old Testament to show that. And we need to remember that oftentimes there were idolatrous offerings and priestly services done in connection with the dead when people were also mourning. So the two ideas kind of run together. Isaiah 15:2, they have gone up to the temple unto Dibon, that's in Moab, even to the high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Those are two other towns in Moab. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. Now that does sound like mourning, but remember, mourning is often connected with idolatry, as people offer up their funeral sacrifices to their pagan gods. Jeremiah 16:6 says this, both great men and small will die in this land. They will not be buried. They will not be lamented. Nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Gash himself or shave his head. Not going to do it. Again, that sounds like mourning, but of course, mourning is associated with sacrifices for heathen gods. Notice in Isaiah 52, it says everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off, the mourning in Moab. It also says in that verse, they have gone up to the temple. Well, that would be to offer idolatrous sacrifices. I failed to mention that to show the connection between pagan worship and pagan mourning. So the priests aren't going to do this. No beard shaving, no hair shaving, no cutting of the flesh. This cutting of the flesh was often done in pagan lands when someone died. Here's a quote from John Gill, quote, either with their nails tearing their cheeks and other parts, or with any instrument, knife, razor. Jarchi, rabbi, says it was the custom of the Amorites when anyone died to cut their flesh, as it was of the Scythians, as Herodotus relates, even those of the royal family. For a king, they cut off a part of the ear, shave the hair round about, cut the arms about. There's your cutting the flesh, shaving the hair, already mentioned in Herodotus. They cut the arms about, wounded the forehead and nose, and transfixed the left hand with arrows. And so the Carthaginians used to tear their hair and mouths in mourning and beat their breast. And with the Romans, the women used to tear their cheeks in such a manner that it was forbid by the law of the 12 tables, which some had thought was taken from hence. And all this was done to appease the infernal deities and to give them satisfaction for the deceased and make them propitious to them. So there again, you have the connection with pagan funerary rites and mourning. Here's another quote showing that from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, the practice of making deep gashes on the face and arms and legs in time of bereavement was universal among the heathen, and it was deemed a becoming mark of respect for the dead, as well as a sort of propitiatory offering to the deities who presided over death in the grave. So there you go. Funeral customs connected with propitiatory offerings, idolatry, pagan services. So that's why the priests weren't supposed to do this. Leviticus 19:28 says, to the priest, you shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, nor make any tattoo marks on yourselves. I am the Lord. Tattoo marks were also associated with funeral practices. Now, verse 6 says that the priest present the offerings by fire to the Lord. The offerings by fire, of course, are the four animal sacrifices and the one grain sacrifice, the food of their God. So the sacrifices are called God's food. Remember, he always got the four fat pieces. And in the case of the burnt offering, he got all the rest of the flesh, too. It's called God's food. The priest had to feed God. It's kind of a crass anthropomorphic way of saying it. We go down to Leviticus 21:7 and 8. They shall not take a woman, the priest, shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to his God. You shall consecrate him, therefore, for he offers the food of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctifies you, am holy. Now, obviously, a priest ought not to shack up with a whore. I don't think that's controversial. What if the woman has quit being a prostitute? What if she has confessed her sin, and she's lived a straight, clean life, virginal life ever since, a secondary virgin? No, that priest should not marry that woman either. A woman who has been profaned, I guess you could translate it that way, by harlotry, no, you can't do that. Now, what about the idea you can't take a woman divorced from a husband? Why? Well, John Gill says this would always make people suppose something was bad or amiss. Why did she divorce her husband to marry this priest? Did the priest engage in some sort of seductive hanky-panky to get that woman to divorce her husband? And then that is going to lead to disrespect for the priesthood. Now, this, of course, seems like it's hard on divorced women who had done nothing wrong. Their husband had put her away. But remember, the needs of the temple, of the tabernacle, the needs of God's holy service are much more above the needs of individuals here. We need to remember that before we start feeling too sorry for this woman. Divorce is a tragedy. Yes, it's a tragedy, but you don't mess up God's typical representations of Christ in any way. I wonder if a priest could abdicate in order to marry a divorced woman. I would think he could. He could just say to the high priest, hey, I appreciate being a priest, but I want to marry this woman. And then the high priest said, okay, you can stop being a priest and you can go marry her. That would be all right. Instead of making a divorced woman suffer, make the priest suffer a little bit. I don't know how he'd make a living after he lost the priesthood, but maybe he could learn how to be a herdsman. And remember, this thing about these requirements for the priest, rank has its responsibilities, folks. That's human life. That's the way it is in this world. Now, the very last word of verse 8 is holy. Consecrate the priest by not letting him marry harlots or divorcees. He offers the food, the sacrifices to God, for he shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctifies you, am holy. That's a formulaic expression that's used all the way through the book of Leviticus. God is holy. The priests are going to be holy. The priests who represent God are going to be holy. And holy, of course, means separated from the world and consecrated unto God. Holiness is the key theme of Leviticus, as the NIV Study Bible says. The word holy appears in Leviticus more than any other book in the Bible, as the NIV Study Bible says. That reference work also says that all of life had a certain ceremonial quality. I don't know what they mean by that exactly, except that there are things that are separate unto God and separate from the world. Lots of things, like animals, which you can eat and which you can't eat. In fact, the word holy indicates that this is the whole purpose of the dietary laws, to make Israelites a peculiar people, not to keep them healthy, although it's not going to be harmful, of course, to follow the dietary laws, but that wasn't the purpose of the Old Testament dietary laws. It was to make Israel a peculiar people so everybody could look, oh, that's a Jew, he doesn't eat pork. Leviticus 21:9, also the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. So the priest couldn't have a prostitute for a wife, and he couldn't have a daughter for a wife. Now, I can imagine the priest would take his daughter and say, now, you know, daughter, the law says that if you become a prostitute, you're going to die. You're going to be burned with fire either while you're alive or your corpse is going to be burned with fire after you're stoned. But that's bad business, so don't be a prostitute. Now, I'd imagine most fathers don't have to exhort their daughters to become prostitutes. I mean, I've known lots of fathers in my time with daughters. I've had two, and I never once counseled them not to be a prostitute because the idea was so alien that I couldn't even, you know, it would be so absurd to think that she would do that, that either one of them would do that. And I suspect that the same thing would be true of a Jewish priest who is a father of a daughter. But he could do that. He could say, hey, you want to be a whore? You're going to die like a whore. Now, the commentator Benson says that by analogy, a priest's wife could do the same thing to the priest, could profane the priest by becoming a whore. And so you could reason by analogy to a wife and say, wife, if you become a harlot, the faggots await you, and you're going to be toast. Likewise, a son, if the son goes out and shacks up with a prostitute, hey, son, a good Jewish lawyer could convict you the same way that my daughter could be convicted if she went out with a prostitute. Now, all of this shows that people do not operate individually. I live in a very, very, very individualistic culture. I can do what I want to do. My actions won't affect anybody. Typical thing is these feminists and social justice warriors who tell a married woman, your husband is just tying you down. All he's doing is asking you to live for him. You need to live for yourself. You need to be individual. You don't have any joint family responsibilities or marital responsibilities. I know somebody this happened to. A self-proclaimed feminist who had been divorced 4 times for obvious reasons told her to go out and find herself. And so this young Chinese mother leaves her daughter, leaves her husband, and travels all over the world without his permission. And, of course, she lost her marriage and had a lot of trouble with her daughter, too. So, no, you make a decision, you are going to affect your family. I remember a brother that I really, really loved. He was a fellow elder in a former church of mine, and he's gone on to be with the Lord now. But he had a son who was not flying right. And he told that son, he says, okay, son, you can keep doing that. You keep doing it, and I'm going to resign from being an elder because what you do affects me and my standing in my church. That really struck me because I was thinking individually. I was thinking, now, wait a minute. I don't want to lose you as an elder just because your son's acting like an idiot. And he was a grown son out of the house, too, so that made my case a little stronger. But my point is, you want to go out and act unrighteously, you will affect your family. I know a family right now, godly couple, neat couple, got an incredibly rebellious daughter, or I think it's a stepdaughter, who's decided she's going to shack up with whoever she wants. She doesn't want to have anything to do with Christianity. She wants to do, I don't know what else she wants to do, drugs, alcohol, you know, the whole thing. And it's killing the parents because what she does affects her parents. You do not live individually in this world. In verse Leviticus 21 verse 9, saying that a daughter can't be a harlot without profaning her father is just one example of this. We go down to Leviticus 21, verses 10 through 12. The priest who is the highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, and who has been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head. This is the New American Standard Bible's translation. Shall not uncover his head, nor tear his clothes. Nor shall he approach any dead person, nor defile himself, even for his father or his mother. Nor shall he go out of the sanctuary, nor profane the sanctuary of his God. For the consecration of the anointing oil of his God is on him. I am the Lord. So now we go to the rules for the high priest, not the ordinary priest. In fact, this is the first time the word high has been used of the priest. First time in the scriptures, as Adam Clark says. And this is where we get the term high priest. Of course, that term was in effect for thousands of years later. The priest who is the highest among his brothers could be his brother Aaronites, his brother the ordinary priest, or it could be the highest among his fellow Israelites, it's not clear, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, that he's talking about the oil that was poured on the high priest's head at his consecration, that is upon Aaron and Aaron's sons that succeeded him. Hear the scriptures, Exodus 29:7, then you shall take the anointing oil and pour it on his head and anoint him. And that anointing oil had specific instructions on what kind of spices were to be included in the oil and in what proportions. Leviticus 8:12, then he poured some of the anointing oil on Aaron's head. That's Moses did that, and anointed him to consecrate him. All right, so this is the high priest we're talking about. He shall not uncover his head. Now, what does that mean? Well, first, let's look at some different translations. The NIV says this high priest should not let his hair become unkempt. The NIV margins the same as the NASB, or not uncover his head. But they put it in the margin and translate it, let not his hair become unkempt. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as the high priest shall not dishevel his hair. And their note, their marginal note says he shall not uncover his head. Now, I submit to you that the NASB translation and the NIV margin and the Holman Christian Study Bible margin uncover his head doesn't make a lot of sense. Why can't the high priest uncover his head? What does that mean? Well, if it's translated as the high priest can't let his hair get unkempt or disheveled, that would show that he is participating in a mourning rite for the dead. You uncover your head and throw your hair and throw it all over the place. Oh, woe is me, my relative has died. High priest can't mourn for his relatives like the ordinary person can. Now, were the ordinary priest allowed to do this? It doesn't say. The law is silent here, but I would think so. They could go touch the corpse. They could go into the house and remain clean. Why shouldn't they do just another part of the funeral exercises, let the hair go wild? Maybe. That might be a question for a Jewish lawyer. Verse 12 says that the high priest shall not go out of the sanctuary. Now, this, of course, in the context, is referring to go out of the sanctuary to take care of the services for his dead relatives. I'm sure they propped him up on a table somewhere in the house and all that stuff that they have to go through. High priest's not going to do that. And, of course, that was probably true for any other reason that he might go out hunting, shopping, visiting, you know, the stuff that ordinary life. High priest's not going to do that. He's separate. He's holy. We go now to Leviticus chapter 21, verses 13 through 15. He, that's the high priest, shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman or one who is profaned by harlotry. These he may not take, but rather he is to marry a virgin of his own people so that he will not profane his offspring among his people, for I am the Lord who sanctifies him. Now it says in verse 13, he shall take a wife. John Gill says that some people take this as a prohibition against polygamy for the high priest. I don't think that's what it says at all. It's just referring to wives in general. It doesn't mean to say he shall take a singular wife. It just means he shall take a general wife. Of all the virgins that are out there, he can take one. I mean, they did allow polygamy back then, so I assume that a high priest could be a polygamist. The wife has to be in her virginity. That's an order to typify the church, because the high priest... Well, the high priest typifies the head of the church, but virginity always stood for purity. 2 Corinthians 11:2, for I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. God talking about his church. For I betrothed you to one husband so that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. That's Paul talking about, I betrothed you to one husband. In other words, the Corinthian church was the bride, Jesus was the husband, and the bride, Corinth, was presented as a, quote, pure virgin when she is getting married to Christ. So virginity symbolizes purity, and so it wouldn't do for a high priest to take a wife who was not a virgin. That would include widows. That would include divorced women. And it obviously would include prostitutes. These are all mentioned here. Now, once again, you say, well, that's not fair to the widow. That's not fair to the divorcee who wants to marry a high priest. Well, you know, if she wants to marry a high priest, I guess the high priest could abdicate and say, I'm not going to be high priest anymore. Pass it on down to my son. Big sacrifice. But that's just the way it was. God's holiness trumps everything else, including personal feelings. Now, here's some thorny cases that arise with this widow prohibition. What happens in the case when a virgin is betrothed to another man and then the other man dies? Now, she's still a virgin because when you're betrothed, you don't have sex, but you are technically married almost. I mean, betrothal was almost like a marriage. So is she a widow or is she a virgin? I guess we'll turn that over to the Jewish rabbis, the Jewish lawyers, to answer that question. What about if the high priest is not a high priest yet? He betroths a widow, and then his father dies, and now it's time for him to be high priest. But he's already betrothed to a widow, and he hasn't been consecrated yet. Does he have to annul his betrothal in order to become a high priest? Maybe he shouldn't be consecrated at all. Maybe he should be forced to resign from the high priesthood because he is betrothed to a widow. Oh, that's an interesting legal thorny question. Again, we'll have to talk to the Jewish rabbis about that one. I don't know how that case would be solved. Those, of course, are hard cases. And as the old legal maxim says, hard cases make bad law. But they are interesting to talk about. They're like a law school question. You get the hardest questions imaginable, and you have to reason your way through the thicket. Now, verse 14 says that the high priest is to marry a virgin of his own people. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean of the tribe of Levi? That can't mean that, because John Gill says high priest could marry into any tribe. I guess he knows that because he knows Jewish rabbinic law. And I think that's probably true. could probably marry anybody of his own people. Another issue is, does that include proselytes? Gill says no. I guess that's debatable. Is a proselyte, especially a proselyte of righteousness, is that one of the high priest's own people? Another interesting question that might arise. We go now to Leviticus 21, verses 16 through 24, and we will finish this audio up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron, saying, No man of your offspring throughout their generations who has a defect shall approach to offer the food of his God. For no one who has a defect shall approach. A blind man, or a lame man, or he who has a disfigured face, or any deformed limb, or a man who has a broken foot, a broken hand, or a hunchback, or a dwarf, or one who has a defect in his eye, or eczema, or scabs, or crushed testicles. No man among the descendants of Aaron the priest who has a defect is to come near to offer the Lord's offerings by fire." That would be the five sacrifices, the four animal sacrifices, and the one grain offering. "Since he has a defect, he shall not come near to offer the food of his God. He may eat the food of his God, both of the most holy and of the holy. Only he shall not go into the veil or come near the altar because he has a defect, so that he will not profane my sanctuaries, for I am the Lord who sanctifies them." So Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel. Now in verse 17, the Lord spoke to Moses, and God told Moses to go then speak to Aaron. Why? Because Aaron's in charge of all the priests, and he's got to make sure all this is carried out. Now obviously here, no defects allowed for a priest. Now here's some options as to why no defects were allowed. The NIV Study Bible says it's to typify Christ's perfection. Just like the sacrifices had to be perfect, the priest had to be perfect. And that, to me, that's the simple answer. If this priest is representing Christ to the people, and that's what a priest is, he's an intermediary between God and the people, well, then you don't want a symbol of our mediator, the New Testament mediator, Jesus Christ. You don't want a symbol of that to be deformed or defective. You don't want the type to be defective in order to show the perfection of the antitype. That makes no sense. Now, another reason, according to Adam Clark, that the priest should not have a defect is that would keep the priest from being contemptible in the eyes of men, thus causing people to despise the ministry. Now, unfortunately, that's the way people are. They make fun of defects. I wish they wouldn't, because I think it's a terrible sin. It's disgusting, actually. But that's what people do. And they would look at that priest and they'd start making fun of the priest. Jameson Foster Brown says this, quote, "As visible things exert a strong influence on the minds of men, any physical infirmity or malformation of body in the ministers of religion, which disturbs the associations or excites ridicule, tends to detract from the weight and authority of the sacred office." And I think that makes a lot of sense. But I think that's a secondary reason. In fact, the reasons overlap. You let the priest be a perfect type of the antitype Christ, well, that also has the side effect of keeping people from mocking the type and thus showing disrespect to the antitype Jesus. Now, this thing of a defect causing the people to have contempt on the priesthood, that would not really apply in the case of crushed testicles or eczema that's under the cloth where you can't see it. So I'm not sure that Jameson Fawcett and Brown's idea of protecting the priesthood from ridicule really fits perfectly here, because nobody's ever going to see those defects. I think it's just because, by golly, the priest is going to be perfect whether you can see the defect or not, because he typifies Christ. There's a third possible reason why defective priests weren't allowed. This is from Adam Clark. Because some defects would have been an impediment in discharging the priestly duties. If his arm's broken or defective and he can't lift something up, for example, lifting a sacrifice up, I imagine that's pretty much a tertiary reason why defects were not allowed. Now, I'm going to give you a great quote from Adam Clark. Quote, "Formerly the Church of England was very cautious in admitting to her ministry those who had gross personal defects, but now we find the humpbacked, the jolt-headed, bandy-legged, club-footed, one-eyed, etc., priest, even of her high places. Why do our prelates ordain such?" Well, now, please, Adam Clark, this is the New Testament. This is not the Old Testament. This is not the Old Testament high priest. I don't have any problem with a humpback minister in the New Testament church. Of course, I don't like these. I'm a low church, house church guy. I just like ordinary brothers who are elders who are not wearing a bunch of fancy clothes and gold collars and big fancy crosses and chains around their neck and hassocks and all that nonsense, all that clerical nonsense. So I would object to that much faster than I would object to such a person who wore such things. because he was a humpback or a jolthead, whatever that is. This is Clark's is so typical of so many commentators who make misguided statements like this when they apply the Old Testament law to the New Testament dispensation. Folks, we are free from the Old Testament law. I'm going through it verse by verse because I like it, but that doesn't mean I'm under it. Now, let me say this, another thing. You read this and you say, oh, well, God doesn't care about deformed people. That's nonsense. Look at Jesus going around healing the lepers in the New Testament. You could say the same thing. Well, he doesn't allow women to be priests, so God hates women. You know, I can hear the feminists and the egalitarians and the morons and the secularists and the social justice warriors and the radical feminists and all of them now bitching, moaning, and whining about God's holy law. Children couldn't be priests either. Are they evil? No. God cares about the lame and the defect people. I mean, Jesus went around healing people much faster than we do today. He loved everybody. God did too. This is a requirement for the high priest, or actually for the priest, because rank has its responsibilities. So if you have a defect, it just means you can't serve in the priesthood. You'll have to make your living somehow else. Doesn't mean that you're less value as a human being. Now, verse 18 says, for no one who has a defect shall approach. Now, what that means is they can't approach the altar in order to do priestly work. It also means they couldn't approach the altar to offer sacrifices for themselves as an individual Israelite. They can't do that. So they couldn't lay out the showbread in the holy place on the table of the bread of the presence. They couldn't do that. They couldn't change out the bread. They couldn't trim the wicks of the seven-branched lampstand in the holy place. They couldn't put incense on the golden altar in the holy place. Just couldn't do it. And they couldn't offer an altar, an offer. Well, I'm assuming that you also can't approach the altar in order to offer a normal sacrifice for himself or his family. Like I say, a peace offering, that might be debatable. But at least he can't perform priestly duties. I debate that about whether he could bring a peace offering for his family to eat, because he's not doing duties then. He would be defective. That's any defective person in the congregation could bring a peace offering, so why shouldn't he be able to? Now, although he can't approach the altar to do priestly sacrifices, to drain the blood, to chop up the animal on the north side of the altar and all that, he can't do that. But verse 22 says he may eat the food of his God. Now, when would a priest eat the food of his God, the sacrifices? The priest got to eat grain offering for others than the priest himself. That grain offering is totally burnt up on the altar. But if it's a grain offering for anybody else, the left a memorial portion is put on the altar, then the rest of the grain mixed with oil is then cooked, baked into cakes and wafers, and the defective priest could eat of that. He can't approach to do work, but he can eat in the courtyard with the rest of his fellow priests. How about a peace offering? In a peace offering, the breast was given to the high priest for all the priests. Well, the defective priest could eat of that. Now, the foreleg was given to the ordinary priest who officiated for the offeror, and the defective priest could not officiate for the offeror, so I guess the defective priest could not ever eat a foreleg, but he could eat the breast. Also, with sin offerings that were given for others besides the high priest and the whole congregation, your typical sin offering, the fat's offered up to the Lord, and the rest of the flesh is eaten in the courtyard. The defective priest could eat the meat of that. Trespass offerings and guilt offerings, all but the fat. The fat was offered up to God on the altar, and the rest, besides the fat, the rest of the flesh, the priest ate in the courtyard. The defective priest could eat that. Or if tithes and first fruits are brought to the temple for first fruit offerings, the priest could eat of that too. So it's just that he can't offer the sacrifice, but the law does not deprive him of the share in the altar that the other non-defective priest had. Verse 14 says, so Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel. Before I go there, let's point out a little distinction here that might not be very obvious. Verse 22, the defective priest may eat the food of his God, both of the most holy and of the holy. There's a distinction between most holy and holy. Now, normally this distinction in Leviticus is very simple. A most holy thing will make something that touches the most holy thing also holy. So if object A is most holy and object B touches object A, then object B is now holy and it cannot be used for profane, ordinary purposes. Now, unfortunately, I don't have the scriptures and I am too lazy to go back and look all this up to find out if any of the sacrifices were categorized as holy and most holy. I probably should do that next iteration, perhaps. But John Gill says that this is referring to a different distinction. He says that some food can only be eaten in the courtyard. For example, the sin offerings, for the ordinary sin offerings that weren't given for a high priest or the whole congregation, but for an ordinary person, they could only be eaten in the courtyard. Well, those are most holy because they're in the courtyard. But other offerings are only holy because they can be eaten outside of the court offering. For example, the peace offering. Who may eat the peace offering? Well, all the priest's family may eat it, the female daughters, the wives, as well as the males, the children. The offeror's family could eat it. So the priest's family and the offeror's family could all get together and have a peace meeting. Where could that be eaten? In the priest's homes. Doesn't necessarily have to be in the courtyard. And so the breast and the foreleg of the peace offering, as well as tithes and first fruits, could be eaten in a nice, big, happy fellowship meal, and the defective priest could share in that, and that would be that peace offering food would be holy. But the most holy food is the sin offering food, which can only be eaten in the courtyard by the priest, not by the priest's sons or wives or daughters or by anybody else. I think Gill's distinction makes a lot of sense here, because I really don't remember where any food was said to be holy or most holy. I could be wrong, but I think Gill's distinction makes sense. Now in verse 23, this defective priest shall not go into the veil or come near the altar. That's because to come near the veil, that's talking about the veil that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. To do that, you would have to, sometimes you had to sprinkle blood in certain sacrifices before the veil. Nope, can't do that. And going into the veil would mean you have to go into the holy place. Can't do that. Can't change the bread of the presence. Can't trim the wicks on the seven-branch candlestick. Also, verse 23 says the defective priest cannot come near the altar. That's talking about the bronze altar of sacrifice. Obviously, he can't come near to offer a sacrifice on the altar because then he would be doing priestly duties, and he can't do that. Verse 24, so Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel. Of course, that doesn't mean all 600,000 males or 2 million Israelites, however many it was. It's not talking about that. The instructions would be given by Aaron to the tribal leaders and to Moses to the tribal leaders, and then they would spread the word to the other elders of the people, and then the elders of the people would then pass it on to everybody else, as John Gill, I am sure, correctly states. Now, one last tidbit here before I leave. I'll have to drop back. I meant to mention this when I was talking about verse 23. The defective priest shall not come near the altar. There's something interesting in the Jewish law that John Gill picked up. Or somebody picked up. I don't know where I got this from. But apparently the Jews later on let priests with defects search for and deworm the wood of the altar. So they wouldn't let them come in and do that work. In my humble opinion, that's getting mighty close to violating the law. But at any rate, we'll let that go. We are now finished with Exodus chapter 21. How to Keep a Priest Holy, Part A. In our next audio, we will turn to Leviticus 22. I'm going to try to do the whole chapter, all 33 verses. We will continue with this idea of a priest holiness, Part B, and then we will look at what is an acceptable sacrifice. So we're going to look at perfect priest and perfect sacrifices, two related things. I hope you stay tuned for that audio in Leviticus 22, and I hope you enjoy this one.